8 Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Gemma Tarlack is with us to look at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science.
First, a new program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison will cover 4 years of tuition and fees for incoming Wisconsin students whose families make $56,000 or less a year.
The plan is called a Bucky's Tuition Promise, and it's scheduled to take effect this fall.
Derek Kindle is the Director of Student Financial Aid at the UW-Madison. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Derek, can you tell us about the goals of the Bucky's Tuition Promise?
Sure. The goal is really simple in that we want to be able to communicate to students and families very clearly about what the commitment of UW-Madison is financially to them should they choose to attend here. And that's really the emphasis around creating Bucky's Tuition Promise.
I want to talk for families who are maybe already accepted into UW. This takes effect this fall, right?
That's correct. And so the families who have been accepted are early action, which was over December. Those students received a notice on last week. And students who applied on or before February 1st, provided they completed their FAFSA, they'll receive a notice for this coming fall as well.
And that's the key. There's not a separate application that people do, right? If they fill out the famous FAFSA form, that financial aid eligibility application form, UW already knows what it needs to know.
Yep, that's correct.
We're talking about Bucky's Tuition Promise, a new plan, a program just announced this week by, or last week, I should say, from UW-Madison, aiming to cover tuition for students from families making under a certain income amount. Derek Kindle is with us, Director of Student Financial Aid at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, telling us how the program works. It's scheduled to take effect, as he just mentioned, this fall. And Derek, where is this money coming from? This sounds like something that could be expensive.
The money is coming from our benefactors, and so our private donors who've donated to us fairly recently and those who continue to donate over time. We're using those resources to assist these students.
So if people are wondering if taxpayer money is going here, not so much?
No taxpayer dollars are used to fill this gap. Now, that is to say that the students who are in this program, many of them will already receive federal and state programs like they normally would under those criteria. But the gap filling, which is what the promise is completely done using private resources and not taxpayer dollars.
And about how many students will be affected by this for each incoming class?
We're anticipating about 800 students per incoming class. Of course, we know that that will perhaps change, and we hope it will go upwards each class. But of course, because we haven't had this program before, we don't have that precise modeling. But our anticipation is at least 800 students per incoming class.
Does this just apply to, I guess, what do you call traditional students just out of high school coming into college, or does it affect other categories of students too?
There is no requirement for Bucky Tuition Promise for this to be someone coming directly from a high school. So this covers both incoming freshmen who may be coming from high school, and it covers transfer students for 2 years.
And looking at some of the comments on our website, one listener wondered, how about non-traditional students, maybe a veteran or someone else returning to school much later than that, not a transfer, not an incoming high school student?
It applies to all students. So we're trying to make the criteria very simple. As long as the household adjusted gross income is at or below $56,000 and they're admitted beginning with the fall of 2018, they can be a non-traditional student, they can be a veteran who's returning to school after some time, or a veteran who's transferring from another institution. This would apply, again, to a student who, a Wisconsin resident who decided to go to Minnesota and wants to perhaps go back to Wisconsin and attend here. So it applies to all of those categories of students.
And some of our listeners were wondering why that $56,000 threshold, why was that amount chosen?
It's roughly the state median household income over the last couple of years averaged. And so we chose that number because it most consistently reflected the median of our state. And it's important to remember that this isn't just for families who make 56 or less. This is for families whose adjusted household income is 56 or less. So we know that there are some families whose income might be higher, their gross income, but the adjusted based on their federal tax return might be a bit lower. So that's an important distinction we would make.
And that's because they'd have more deductions because they have more kids,
correct,
or things like that?
Yep, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, and then...
So we don't want people to get discouraged who are making above 56, but whose adjusted gross income might be lower.
Now, do students who participate in this, are they expected to attend full-time?
They're strongly encouraged to attend full-time, but there is no full-time requirement. What we do caution against is not using full-time means you still get the same number of terms or semesters that we'll cover. So that is finite. So we'll cover the 8 semesters, for example, for incoming freshmen, 4 for an incoming transfer student.
And as I understand it, this would not apply if I want to get some credits in during the summer.
Correct. The university does have some other scholarship opportunities for summer enrollment, but Bucky's Tuition Promise specifically does not cover study abroad or summer enrollment.
And as I understand it, for families that get this notice that they can participate in Bucky's Tuition Promise, shouldn't throw away any applications to other kinds of financial aid. That could still be beneficial to them, right?
Oh, absolutely. We all know that there are additional costs above tuition and fees for any institution, and so anything that a student can get will certainly be helpful to offset their education-related expenses.
Can you talk about this in a big picture as far as the mission of UW-Madison and serving people around Wisconsin?
Sure. Our mission as the land-grant institution in Wisconsin is to make sure that we sort of open wide the gates of access to people around the state. And we've been doing so in many ways over the last several years, but we really try to determine how can we let people know in a way that they can easily understand and plan for many years down the road. And that is what we're doing. Historically, we've used expected family contribution, which is a sort of complicated algorithm that comes out of the FAFSA, and that really isn't the best communication piece for students or their families. And so using the adjusted gross income, where a student or a family can look at a line on their taxes, we're hoping will be a whole lot more clear, and making sure that we tell them up front that this is something you can count on for 4 years or 2 years, depending on how you're coming in, we also thought was incredibly important.
We'll leave it there for now. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Derek Kindle, Director of Student Financial Aid at the UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about a plan that pledges to cover tuition and selected fees for incoming Wisconsin students whose families make $56,000 adjusted or less each year. Right now, new advancements in genetic science have made it possible for scientists to know more about our ancestors from around the world than ever before. Today, we'll find out what we're learning about Vikings.
We'll check out those latest discoveries along with a debate about how we use antibiotics, as well as talk to our famous and favorite science writer at Central Time.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hello. It's great to be with you again.
We're going to start with the Vikings. Who's going to play quarterback? Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong Vikings.
These are the Vikings that people care about.
Right. Exactly. So we're learning a lot about Vikings. First, talk about the tools that are out there that we're getting this new information from.
Yeah, well, this is a really fascinating and very hot field within Viking Age research. And, you know, if you think about how do we find out things about the Vikings, you probably think that somebody goes with a shovel to a site in Iceland or Norway or Sweden, and they start digging and they start looking for pieces of a boat or other, artifacts or maybe even human remains. But the fact is that the really hot and exciting area of Viking Age research now is all done with DNA. And it's coming from a few different sources. You can look at modern populations and look at their DNA and kind of trace back their ancestry, which is what, you know, many of us do with those tests that are so popular right now. But you can also actually extract ancient DNA from these remains that are more than 1,000 years old. And the techniques are just getting so good now that we're learning more and more and more from this ancient DNA. And my favorite area of this research is actually ancient and modern DNA from sources other than humans that is telling us about humans. And what I mean by that, the researchers are able to extract DNA, both again from modern and ancient populations of animals and plants. And based on those findings, they are able to deduce certain things about Viking travel patterns, which to me is just fascinating.
Right, and this is so Viking. One of the things they're using is ancient cod bones, like the fish.
Yeah, And I love this this line of research. They found all these ancient cod bones that were in these settlements in Germany. Not necessarily Viking settlements at all, but they were just settlements in Germany and other areas of Central Europe where people were eating cod. And they looked at these cod bones found at these settlements and got the DNA from the bones and were able to figure out that the actual cod came from an archipelago in Arctic Norway called Lofoten. And it is a beautiful, beautiful place. And they have a very ancient cod tradition. And they figured out that the Vikings started up this cod trade network that persists even today.
Wow. Now, are we learning stuff that is placing Vikings in the, I guess, pre-medieval era in places we didn't know where they were?
Yes, yes. In fact, my favorite study out of all of the ones that I looked at while I was writing the story, it's about the Viking mice, the littlest Vikings. And basically, you know, there are all these little islands that are barely more than specks of land in the Atlantic Ocean. Specifically, I'm looking at Madeira, which is now part of Portugal. But we thought for a long time that the first Europeans to arrive at Madeira were the Portuguese. So a researcher some years ago who was looking at modern mice on that island was testing their DNA and expected to find that they were descended from mice that had lived in Portugal. And he found something very different. He actually found that the mice had, on this island that we thought would be Portuguese mice, the mice actually had genetic signatures of Viking-age Norwegian mice. So they think what happened, you know, there's no historical document, there is no wrecked longboat or Viking grave on the island, but they think that what happened was a Viking ship, maybe either exploring or getting blown off course, ended up on this island and, you know, stopped for a while to maybe get some fresh water, get some more food, and then left. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the mice that were hitchhiking on the ship took a little shore leave and never made it back to the boat and ended up living on this island for perpetuity. So, you know, it's really fascinating that not only what we can deduce from ancient and modern DNA, but the fact that we don't need, say, human remains to tell us that humans were at a site.
Gemma, are we being too quick to roll out, like, little mice building tiny longboats themselves and going all over the Atlantic? I mean, I know we don't have direct evidence. Could it be? I'll take that as a no.
you work on developing that theory in your spare time, buddy.
So the exciting thing here is what we can do with DNA in tracing not just Vikings and their mice, but populations all around the world. How far back can we go, though? What is the, I don't think half-life is the right word, but how far back can we still test something for its DNA?
Well, just to extract DNA and to sequence it, you know, they're able to do it now with some specimens that are more than 500,000 years old. The problem is the further back you go in time, the more natural degradation there is, because as soon as the organism dies, microbes start getting in there and just feasting. And in addition to destroying the DNA, a lot of times bacteria and other life forms kind of leave their own genes mixed in with the genes of the organism that has died. So they're getting better all the time. I mean, just in the past 5 or so years, they have pushed back that date by hundreds of thousands of years. So we're still kind of at that, you know, 500,000 mark, and that's only for DNA that has been preserved under the perfect conditions, which is basically a dry condition that's cold. So you need dry and you need cold to preserve DNA. So that's why it's so tricky the further back you go in the fossil record.
And it sounds like if I'm a scientist who wants to study the movement of people around the world, I don't need to go out right now. Maybe my priority isn't to go out and find new sites. I want to start going to the natural history museums and the labs and the archives, right? Because there's got to be a lot of stuff out there that hasn't been DNA tested.
Yes, there is. And, you know, I've written before on other stories where they are looking at museum samples now that have been just, you know, sitting in back rooms for sometimes centuries and testing them for DNA. And that is a very promising area of research. But the issue with that is always what archaeologists and anthropologists call the provenance of an item. You have to be clear that you are testing an item that has kind of a really good chain of custody, that you know where it was found and how it was handled. The whole way from when it was excavated to being put on the museum shelf, just because, you know, things can get very easily contaminated. But we have a lot of material that has good provenance, that does have a chain of custody, and is now actually being tested for DNA extraction and analysis.
One more question before we move on from this, Gemma. What question, Viking or otherwise, around the world, are you hoping gets solved by this DNA testing?
I know you were going to ask me about building a time machine.
No time machines today, I promise. I promise.
Well, you know, I mean, my thing about science is that I just like watching it advance, being able to see it advance, and being able to see old theories get refined or sometimes overturned. I just really like kind of the progress of our understanding. So there's not one particular question. I'm just really excited that this is a whole new area that researchers can now explore.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some the most cool stories from the world of science over the last few months. Gemma, let's switch gears here and talk about antibiotics. Now, if I get antibiotics from a doctor, I think the label always says, keep taking this stuff, even if you feel better halfway through. You know, they more medical jargony than that, but that's the gist. That's open to debate, I understand it.
Yeah, and you know, fortunately, I don't have to go to the doctor often, but I know when I do, they always tell you, in addition to what it says on the bottle, like, you have to take this, you have to take this, you have to take this till there are none left. And it turns out that there was a recent commentary in one of the most respected medical journals out there, the BMJ, and the author said, hey, you know, we have actually known for decades that stopping antibiotics early does not cause resistance in antibiotics. And this, you know, when I read this commentary, my mind was blown because I thought, we've known about this for decades? What? But yeah, it turns out that there is a lot of evidence that actually taking antibiotics longer increases a risk that they'll develop resistance. And so this is kind of the view that's emerging now, and I think it's very important for anyone listening out there and taking antibiotics, don't just quit. Don't go cold turkey, because
right,
this is not settled science. But basically, there is a growing camp within the field saying, hey, we're giving people the wrong message, and they should actually stop taking antibiotics when they feel better. Now, of course, there is another camp among doctors saying, hang on, we just do not have enough evidence to make this kind of conclusion, to start telling people to stop taking the antibiotics. And their argument, the camp that is arguing, yes, you must finish your antibiotics, they are saying there is not enough research out to be sure that you can quit antibiotics early, that it may actually vary from one type of infection to another. For example, if you have an ear infection and you stop taking your antibiotics midway, you might be at a higher risk of a relapse. So they're calling for more research looking at specific infections and the specific response to the antibiotics for those infections. So the jury is still out as far as I'm concerned, but it's a really interesting thing, because I don't know about you, but I kind of thought this was settled science. Apparently not.
Right, and hopefully there is research, because the core problem here, antibiotic resistance, is a big deal.
Yes, it's a huge deal. And, you know, there was that poor woman last year who unfortunately passed away, who had an infection that was not responsive to any known antibiotic. And, you know, fortunately, this is the wave of the future, because antibiotics very quickly develop resistance. And partly it's from overuse, just, you know, being prescribed too many antibiotics, or perhaps antibiotics for something that should not have an antibiotic. So, yeah, there is definitely overuse, but the jury is still out on what is proper use.
I want to turn to one more a column from Discover on end-of-life care and spirituality. What's the connection there?
Yeah, this is, you know, it's a really interesting avenue that I think we don't often talk about, either in the pages of a magazine or just in conversation between family and friends, or even with your doctor. And it's looking at the impact of spirituality on the quality of life for terminally ill people. And the doctor that our writer follows, Tracy Balboni out of Harvard, she's defining spirituality as a search for meaning and purpose, which may or may not include reference to the divine. So we're not talking necessarily about people who are religious, but just people who are spiritual, whether or not they have religious beliefs. And it's really about the search for meaning. And what they're finding is that can really impact not only a patient's quality of life, but the decisions they make. You know, do you go into hospice? Do you have the advanced directives about care, you know, at that time? And it's very interesting. It's a new field, but it's very interesting, the results that she and her colleagues are finding, some of which are pretty counterintuitive.
Like what?
Well, for example, you know, you might think that someone who's deeply religious would be very much okay passing away and go into hospice and, you know, just focus on making their last days comfortable and sort of, you know, be ready to pass away. Where they're finding the more a person goes to outside religious figures for support, such as pastors or fellow parishioners or very religious relatives, that those people are the most likely to end up in an intensive care unit using extreme measures to prolong their life, regardless of, say, levels of pain or quality of life. So that's just one of the findings. And they have this whole new initiative that was just recently launched in at Harvard called the Initiative on Health, Religion, and Spirituality. And they're looking at all different ways of addressing this issue with the goal that, you know, individual patients are different, and how can doctors maximize their final days, make them comfortable both physically and just emotionally.
Interesting. Well, Gemma, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you. I'll look forward to the next time.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She's based in Waukesha.
First, when it comes to some of the richest and most fulfilling relationships in life, friendships are right there near the top of the list. While friendships provide us with a special kind of love and support, they can also be complex and even confusing, whether we're talking about casual acquaintances or BFFs.
Our next guest is an expert on women's friendships, which she says can be rewarding but often intense and complicated. In a new book, she shares stories from women around the world with a wide range of life experiences and various perspectives on what friendship means.
F. Diane Barth joins us now. She's a New York City-based psychotherapist and the author of the new book, I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. Diane, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, JC. Thank you for having me.
So there's something pretty unique about every kind of relationship in life. It can be between a parent or child, maybe between a brother and sister, so on. So with that in mind, what do you think is unique and special about the relationship that is a friendship between two women?
Well, we all have the image in our mind of two women who have been best friends since they were children and who stayed connected for their whole lives and whose relationship, has fulfilled them. And I talked to lots of women while I was doing the research for I Know How You Feel about who had these kinds of friendships. But I think that another thing that's really important is that women, while we do connect to one another through feelings, we also have many, many other ways of connecting. And actually, one of the things that I found most interesting and most exciting was that there are lots of different ways that women have friendships.
Well, and I'd like to get to that in a second, but just to maybe do some contrasting, what do you think is similar or different comparing women's relationships to maybe two male friends?
The easiest thing that people kept saying to me is, well, you know, women connect by talking about feelings, and men connect by doing things. And while there's some truth to that to some extent, I actually found that there are a lot of exceptions to that rule, that a lot of women connect by doing things. And a number of men who I just happened to talk to sort of accidentally, because men were as excited about this this subject as women were, a number of men told me about very emotionally meaningful friendships. So the truth was that I came away not so sure what all the big differences were.
Sure. So maybe it's one of those societal constructs that is maybe less divisive than maybe we thought it was.
I think so.
So you also write in the book that there is a cultural expectation, maybe it goes back to the connections, that women are supposed to be good at friendship, and that it's smooth sailing and we never have to worry about making friends or keeping friendships. Do you think that there is a higher expectation on women to, you know, do this?
I think there is. And one of the things that I heard from so many women was something that one woman put this way. She said that she was really bad at friendships, that she felt badly because she wasn't able to stay in touch with women she had known. But then when I sort of pushed her a little bit, it turns out that she made really meaningful friendships with women in situations. So she had friends at work. When she left a job, she didn't stay in touch with those friends, although she still cared about them, and she actually even said that she followed them on Facebook, but she just didn't stay in touch. And she made new friends at her new job, and she was very connected to those new friends, and as well as she had been connected to the old friends. Same thing with another woman who had a woman who was in her 60s who had had children and was now, you know, her children had gone off to college. Her children were grown. She had been very involved in her career. She was very established. She didn't need to keep working on focusing on it. And her marriage was established and settled. And she told me that she felt also like she had not been a good friend, and that probably many of her friends had fallen off because she had not been there for them. But in fact, she also had developed some really important friendships with people who just they weren't these deep, you know, tell me all your feelings kinds of friendships.
Do you think that with women in particular, there might be sort of a hierarchy of friendships, that maybe that best friend forever is sort of the ideal that everyone wants to shoot for, but maybe their work friendships are just as fulfilling?
Oh, I think so for sure. I would imagine you're a working woman that's probably something you're aware of or know about. But yeah, that is certainly my experience of what women told me, that there's a hierarchy, but even it's not even quite a hierarchy. It's that you have different friends you do different things with. You have different friends who have different kinds of meanings. Sometimes the best friend from elementary school is not the person who you can talk to about your work life. I actually talk about two women in the book. I changed everybody's names and identifying information in the book. But in the book, I call them Liz and Eileen. And they were very, very close in middle school and in high school. They sort of lost contact. They had a falling out during college. And then they reconnected as adults. But they told me that as close as they were and as much as they meant to each other, they each had other friends who they could talk to about things that they couldn't share with each other. And I heard that over and over again.
We're talking to F. Diane Barth. She is a psychotherapist based in New York City, and she is the author of I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. And that is what we're talking about, female friendships right now. So, Diane, for this book, you interviewed women from all over the world with a wide range of life experience. We've touched a little bit on those. You know, what were you hoping to learn or maybe find a common thread between all these women?
I actually was initially interested in the ways that friendships change over the course of our lifetime. So one of the things that I was engaged in was the idea that we have certain kinds of friends when we're in high school, different kinds of friends when we're in college. When we move out into the world and the work world and moving into relationships of our own, friendships change again, and so on and so forth, all the way through middle life, and then as we get older, friendships change again. I was interested in that. There was certainly research that said that our friendships drop off as we get older. And what I found was that the relationships between women do change. The kinds of friendships we have do change over time. The number of friendships we have do change. but that to sort of against what we might think, that some of the friendships in later adulthood have more, well, not surprisingly, more maturity, but also more connectedness, more understanding, more acceptance of difference than at any other time in our lives. So that was a surprise to me, but I was interested in sort of what happens developmentally.
There have also been, maybe in recent years, a lot written, certainly focusing on women. Maybe men don't necessarily ask this, about whether or not they can have it all. And it's usually conversations about career, fulfilling family life. But friendships don't seem to be part of that conversation. Do you think that it's worth looking at?
Oh, sure. And that is one of the things that I heard, sorry, over and over again, was that that we can't have it all, that it's really hard to, you can't be the kind of good friend, even when you start a job, when you leave college and you start a job and you're out in the world, you're not going to be able to be available to the buddy who wants to come hang out with you in the middle of the night the way you were when you were in a dorm or living together in an apartment. And you know, the two of you could hang out all night if you needed to. It's just not the same. And so many women talked about mourning some of those things that in their friendships that they couldn't have as they moved on in their lives.
We're talking about friendships among women. Our guest is F. Diane Barth. She is the author of the new book, I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Talk about the role that friends and friendship play in your life. What holds friendships together? How has that changed over your life? Does it mean something different now to have a friend than it did, say, 10 years ago or 30 years ago? Do you find it difficult to maintain those friendships? Do you have that one lifelong friend you can still tell everything to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Diane Barth is with us. Her new book is I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. She's sharing stories of friendships among women and answering your questions at 800-642-1234.
What's your key to success when it comes to long-lasting friendships? What worries do you have when it comes to your friends? And do you find it's easier or more difficult to make friends with individuals of your same gender? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Diane, I want to take a call. We have Jessica from Milwaukee. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
And what'd you have to say?
Well, I think that, you know, I've had this conversation with some of my girlfriends about how devastating it can be when you lose a female relationship. But I feel like people don't talk about how to deal with that the same way that they do when you end a romantic relationship. Like, there's tons of advice on when you break up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, but there's not really a lot of resources or support when you lose a friendship.
So, Diane and Jessica, thank you so much for that call. So, Jessica is concerned that it's not even discussed about the loss of a female friendship or even rejection from female friends. I know you cover that in your book. So, what are your thoughts on what Jessica had to say?
It's a great question, and yeah, there's not a huge amount of research or advice out there. I'm not sure why, but one of the things that I found was that it's really important to recognize how important these relationships are, and it's important to recognize how important it is when one ends, and they end in a lot of different ways. Sometimes there's a betrayal by a friend, and that can be extremely painful. I write about one woman whose name is Daphne in the book who was betrayed by her best friend and her husband. She found the two of them in bed together, and so had to deal with this double betrayal. And it, the pain of losing your very close, very dear friend can be every bit as bad as the pain of losing a spouse or a parent or a sibling. Because it, what people told me was that, that women become part of our lives. They become part of our whole selves. And when we lose them, it's like we lose a part of ourselves. So I think the advice that you get from any kind of relationship counselor is going to be the same advice as you would get about, you know, for dealing with a romantic relationship is going to be the same as the advice for dealing with a friend. One thing is, if you can do it, to talk with them and try to find out what's going on. Often I find that people take things personally that are not actually intended personally, and that's for women sometimes a really difficult part of our relationships. And one of the things that I've heard over and over again was that as we get older, we get a little more comfortable with those interactions and not taking things quite so personally. I'll tell you a quick story, and then I want to also get to ghosting, which I think is really important and which doesn't get discussed so much in women's relationships, but it's there. But I had one woman tell me about she was a woman in her 60s. Her very dear friend from childhood was getting very crotchety and unpleasant, and she finally realized that it had nothing to do with her. It had to do with the fact that this friend was not hearing and was refusing to get her hearing checked and refusing to go for a hearing aid. So she finally said to this friend, listen, I love you, and you're just ruining our friendship, and could you please go get a hearing aid? I think you really need help hearing. And the friend was furious with her. But so they didn't speak for a couple of weeks, and then a couple of weeks later, the friend called and said, I got a hearing aid. Thank you. And they never spoke about it again.
And it sounds like sometimes you need that friend to be the one to tell you, hey, you're having a problem. We are talking right now to F. Diane Barth. She's the author of I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. You know, we have another caller on the air. We have Valerie from Milwaukee. Valerie, what would you like to say?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, I understand that, you know, there's a lot of women out there that lead very busy lives, and that can lead to, you know, miscommunications or loss of communications with friendships, and I think there's a lot of guilt associated with that. I just wanted to bring up, you know, the idea of how guilt can make you not want to form friendships in the future. I just wanted to hear thoughts on that.
Yeah, so Diane, what do you think that maybe feeling bad about your, I guess, how well you can be in a friendship might prevent you from seeking out new friends?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think, and actually, just to go back to the idea of ghosting, I think that is one of the reasons that people ghost sometimes, is that they feel guilty that they're not living up to the friend's expectations. So I think guilt goes two ways. It comes from us. It comes from the feeling that we're not being what we expect ourselves to be, and so we don't put ourselves in the position of feeling inadequate or inferior or less than perfect. And we also feel pressure from friends to be more than we can be. One of the stories I heard was from a woman who was who had just had her second child and really had no time. She had no time for anything. She had two little children. And one of her friends couldn't tolerate that she wasn't available anymore to be there for her, and when the young mother would say, listen, come over, we'll hang out with the kids, the friend would say, no, I don't want to be with the kids, I want to be with you. And in this case, the guilt didn't end the friendship. It was the friend's inability to tolerate that her friend's life had changed and that she was not available in the same way. But I think that guilt can do the same thing. It can make us withdraw and not move forward into new friendships.
So we've been talking a fair amount about the loss of friendships, sometimes they naturally kind of fade away. But what do you think are some of the ways that women, and I'm going to say parenthetically, and men, what they can do to make sure that their friendships are successful going forward?
I'm glad you said that, because I found over and over again that men were as interested in this subject as women, and that men also felt inadequate about the ways that they made friends, but that many men have these very important, meaningful friendships in their lives. One of the things that I think is that a great benefit, one of the positive things about social media, is it does provide a way for staying in touch. So staying in touch is really important. My husband and I have had this conversation many times. He will not call a friend if he doesn't have a reason to call. So he won't, he has to have something. There has to have been a baseball game or a football game or a basketball game that they can talk about or something. I think that the idea of being able to just connect and just say, I'm calling just to see how you're doing, what's happening, and also in this day and age to recognize that those connections are often very short. We don't have time for long conversations. Doesn't mean we don't care about each other. I think one other thing that's really important that both men and women struggle with is the idea of being able to tolerate difference and conflict. We like our friends to be like us. We want them to be different enough so that they're interesting, but we like them to be like us. And I think that it's really important to be able to make space for differences, which is not easy in a friendship, but it's really important.
So for people who are maybe embarking on a new friendship, maybe getting past that awkwardness of, it almost sometimes feels like a first date with when you're trying to make a new friend, how would you tell people to maybe, kind of put it past themselves and just dive right in?
Well, I'm a big believer in activities. So one way that to sort of remove some of the first date awkwardness is you don't have to go out for coffee or a glass of wine or just talk until you get to know each other. You can go for a walk. You can go, you could go bowling. You could go to the movies. You can go to hear a lecture. Anything that is interesting and that engages both of you. It could be something that's outside of your comfort zone or the other person's comfort zone, but it gives you something to bond over, and that's a really good beginning to a friendship.
So you could both find that you're both really good at bowling or both terrible at bowling, and maybe that can be the best way to kickstart a friendship, sounds like.
Exactly.
In the last minute that we have here, I know you also blog. Are there any exciting things that you're hoping to work on or things that you're parsing out moving forward with these friendships conversations?
Well, thank you for asking that. The friendship conversations were so exhilarating to me and so wonderful that I'm still having them. And so one of the things I've been moving forward on is the Me Too movement, the issue of women's solidarity, and actually of men and women together standing up for each other against bullies. And so I'm collecting more and more really interesting stories. And again, more and more very complex and nuanced stories, which I just find fascinating. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with them. I've done several blogs now on Psychology Today and on Quartz.
So a lot to look forward to. Diane, thank you so much for joining us today. F. Diane Barth is a New York-based psychotherapist and the author of a new book, I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives.
There are a lot of ways to idle away your time on the internet. A lot of entertaining, fun, zany things out there. One thing that I wouldn't have expected to be on that list of fun, zany things online is the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission Twitter feed. JC, you found out I was wrong.
You were totally wrong. This was a fun discovery that Dean, my colleague who's in the studio with us, and I found today. It is... perhaps, I don't know how it got so zany, but for a federal agency to have some both incredibly helpful information and some totally bonkers information. It kind of just blows the mind.
Right. Their post today, it's Abe Lincoln's birthday, right? And so there's this really inspiring picture of Abe Lincoln encouraging us to unite against eating laundry pods, because this internet challenge,
yes, this
for some
internet
reason.
Challenge, apparently it
don't
says
do it.
Lincoln United. They have a bunch of these, just people united against doing sometimes goofy things. But you also get to learn about pizza-related injuries. Thousands that you would not have known about otherwise. But yeah, they do have some serious things on there as well. But I feel like I kind of learned a lot today between the goofy and the serious.
Right. Watch for the recalls out there.
Watch
That's
for the
important.
Recalls.
And be entertained at the same time. That is the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission Twitter feed. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.